music and movie fans. This is Sutton, your host on Sutton on Cinema and Sound, and I'm joined here today by my guest host, who is my dad.
Hi everyone, Mike here.
So today we are reviewing diving once again into Doctor Who, into what is definitely considered one of the most important episodes in the entire series, and this is 1969, The War Games. So would you like to attempt to give a brief synopsis of what you remember of the plot, and then maybe I can fill in the gaps for you?
Okay, and there will be many gaps, okay. I suspect. This was a 10-episode arc in which the Doctor and his companions, Jamie and Zoe, land somewhere on Earth. They don't know where and they don't know when, but they land in a field that is kind of wet and muddy. And they soon discover that they're in the middle of some kind of a war. And it turns out to be World War I. They are civilians in the middle of a war zone, so they're taken in for questioning. And they, over the course of 10 episodes, uncover and become involved with different war zones, often getting captured, questioned, escaping from numerous high-pressure situations. There is, early on in maybe the first episode, a gentleman by the name of Smythe, who, when he puts on glasses, seems to have a hypnotic effect on people. And we also learn that he has, in his office, a picture, and behind it is a communications device. So there's something certainly odd going on here, because that is not what you would expect in the zone that they're in, which is a World War I zone. So the Doctor is put on trial, and there doesn't seem to be enough evidence, but when Smythe puts on his glasses, he convinces his companions that the Doctor and his companions are guilty. So they are then imprisoned. What we finally and slowly determine over the course of various episodes is that there are different war zones. And some of the people involved report seeing this mist. And what we find out is that the mist is some kind of a barrier between these different time zones and war zones. You've got the World War I zone, you've got the American Civil War zone, you've got the British and Scottish fighting, you've got another zone, which is, which zone is that? There's another different war zone. So there are these various war zones. And Smythe is just one of the various henchmen. Ultimately, there is a warlord that is in charge of all of this effort, and what they are doing is a scheme to study, you know, man and Earth and their ability to fight and combat in these various zones, and they're building up an army that they eventually hope to be able to control so that they can then take over the complete galaxy. So this turns out to be a plot that is probably beyond the capabilities of the Doctor on his own. And for the first time, we find out a bit of an origin story of the Doctor, in which we find out that he left his home planet and the Time Lords because he had a bit of a disagreement with them. And the Time Lords had these TARDISes, but they used them really to study what was going on in the universe and study different worlds, and not to become involved in them, just to learn for their own knowledge. And the Doctor had a different view of things. You've got these, you know, this ability to go out to different worlds, but why not help them when you can? So he stole a TARDIS and went out for purpose of going to different worlds, wherever he kind of lands, because he can't really necessarily control the TARDIS, but to provide some benefit. So he has cut off from his home planet and the Time Lords, and this is the first time that he reaches back to try to provide some assistance. He knows there are going to be consequences because he committed crimes. So the Time Lords assist, but he has to go back to the home planet. They force him back with the TARDIS because they put force fields around it so that he can't operate it. And they then hold a trial for the warlord and for the doctor as well for the various crimes. The warlord is found guilty and his existence is essentially erased, and his people are now being controlled so that they can't do the same type of attempts to take over the galaxy. And the doctor is found guilty as well, but he pleads of why he did it and the benefits that he was able to provide to various worlds. And we get to the end of the doctor in that he is now forced to take on a new identity, to go back to Earth. He has a TARDIS, but he can't control it, so he is now kind of shackled, if you will, from doing what it was that he was doing. And his two companions are sent back to their various worlds and times, to the time prior to their meeting the Doctor, so that they don't even know that the Doctor exists as they go forward. That is a 10-episode arc in 30 seconds, eliminating 95% of the action and probably a good part of the meaning as well.
Yeah.
So please fill in the blanks.
All right, that was actually very thorough. Just a couple things for that. So to be clear, although they initially thought that they really landed on Earth and in World War One, it actually was in fact not Earth. It was rather a simulation of it on the aliens. I believe it was the aliens' home planet. Another is that so Jamie and Zoe are sent back to their own times at the time they met the Doctor, and the Time Lord specified that their memories of the Doctor, of their adventures with the Doctor and the TARDIS will be wiped, except for their first adventure with him, which is basically when they first meet the Doctor in what is their own time. So Jamie will remember meeting the Doctor and who his current companions were in the Highlands, but then he'll just think that he saw the Doctor leave. He won't remember that he actually left with the Doctor in the TARDIS. And then the same thing with Zoe. So they'll remember who, they theoretically sure remember who the Doctor is, but not anything about actually taking off with him in the TARDIS or any of their adventures, anything like that. And this was a really interesting story and in how it kind of kept misleading the viewer. First, I feel like one would think that it's like a purely historical episode where the Doctor and his two companions get caught up in as civilians in World War One, but then it turns out that there is this mysterious General Smythe who has these hypnotic glasses and then also the sort of like the telephone communication system, but where he kind of like where he can like he takes Zoom calls with the others who are in league with him, which of course is too futuristic for 1910s technology. So then the viewer would think that there's like a time meddler within World War One, but then it turns out even further that it's not even World War One, and it's not even Earth, but it's rather a simulation of it.
This was peeling back layers of an onion.
Yeah.
And as you get through the 10-episode arc, you were constantly finding out that there was more behind the scenes and more going on and more being revealed with each and every episode.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was a very important structure to have for something this long, because it's really important to keep the viewer invested and not really give everything away, but rather like reveal small details about what is really going on slowly over time as each episode unfolds.
And remember, this came out in 1969, when you would watch an episode and then have to wait a week for the next episode.
Yeah.
And each episode actually had a few seconds of kind of recap from the last scene of the prior episode. And we were watching it as we watch television today, how we consume it, binge watching one episode after the other. And I'm like, we just saw this. Why are they showing this again? But that's the way it was back then. And each episode had its own cliffhanger, and you would have to wait a week to find out how they got out of that sticky situation.
Yeah, exactly. So this would have, we saw this over the course of 2 days, but back in 1969 in Great Britain, this would have been watched over the span of 10 weeks. So that would have been 2.5 months worth of Doctor Who. And it's interesting how, like, by the end of the serial, you wonder if viewers would, you would have to also keep track of what's been going on since the beginning of it, since, like, episode one.
And those were the days, actually, not just weekly cliffhangers, but you would have series, cliffhangers where you would have to wait till the following year's episodes to find out what would happen. One of the most classic examples of that was from Dallas and Who Shot J.R., where they build it up through the entire season. You wouldn't get the answer until the following year.
That kind of reminds me also of even like Star Trek in the 90s when like Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, a lot of their seasons would end on, they would have two-parters, but where the season would end on the part one of the two-parter, and then the next season would start on the part two. So they would, I guess, leave you hanging for like most of the year, wondering how the cliffhanger would be resolved.
So that's part of the drama and the excitement of series television back then, that you lose a little bit of these days when an entire season gets released together on a streaming service, and you sit down and you watch it all the way through.
Yeah, and that, you know, this is interesting because this was actually one of the things I was, you know, interested in hearing your thoughts on. Because I feel like having a show that's this serialized was, unheard of today, but I just think that it must have been more common back in the 60s. But then I remember that when I first told you about it, you also kind of acted with surprise. Do you remember, I guess, any shows or anything that was formatted similar to this?
With like a 10 episode arc
or even just
like
four episodes or six episodes, which was like the most common.
Yeah, you would have a lot of shows, and many shows would have a story through line that would go from episode to episode, and you'd have to watch the next episode to see what the resolution was. And that was what was, you know, what would lead to event television or water cooler television. It used to be that in offices, people would congregate around the water cooler as kind of a social break, and they would talk about last night's television that they would watch and discuss that cliffhanger, and wasn't that great, and what's going to happen, and they'd speculate about it. So that was pretty common structure back then. Maybe not quite like the structure of Doctor Who, where you would have a 10-episode arc that was defined that way, or a 7-episode arc defined that way. But it would be more or less the similar kind of approach where, you know, they would want you coming back for that next episode next week to find out how this situation got resolved. And you just don't have kind of that water cooler television moments anymore. Like you did back then, because it was pretty common that people would watch the same shows, everybody would see them, and they'd all talk about them the next day at work.
Yeah, I mean, this is a show that I really enjoy watching now, because basically all the episodes, aside from the some that are missing, are like available on a lot of streaming services. So if I want to find out what happens, how the cliffhanger is resolved, then I just can watch the next episode instantaneously. And yeah, I wonder how, if I would have, you know, liked watching this show back in, if I were living in the 60s, because basically I'd be kidding each week to watch what would really be like 1/4 or 1/6 of a story. And even the modern Doctor Who show, they just have, they have like a really, I guess, normalized format, which is just like one self-contained 45-minute episode. And then occasionally they'll have two-parters.
So once you get to that point, then you don't really have to come back next week to see what happens.
Yeah.
You can miss an episode. And then once you miss an episode, you realize that, well, you know, maybe this isn't that important to my life. So I think there's this tendency to potentially lose viewers over the course of a season if you have each episode as a standalone. And I think that's why they kind of structured things commonly that way back then.
Yeah, although it is interesting that I feel like what the show and shows in general will do now is they will have season-long arcs. Where Doctor Who, the season-long arcs are kind of loose, like more loose, where a lot of the episodes are still self-contained, but then they'll have hints that eventually lead up to what is the series finale. Whereas the old show, they'll have the season broken down into these smaller serials. But normally the season, what defines the season, like the first serial in the season and the last serial in the season, is more like coincidentally what happens to be the first one that's broadcast in, I guess, what was considered the broadcasting season. Although this serial was actually first off, to allude to its length of 10 episodes, this was actually rare even for Doctor Who, because this was the third longest serial from the classic series. And this actually is the 7th and final serial from other season 6 of the show. And this, unlike a lot of the final serials of the season, this definitely feels like the end of an era on a lot of accounts. So first off, this is actually the final serial and set of episodes that was filmed and broadcast in black and white. This is the final that had the second Doctor, and also the final to have the companions Jamie and Zoe, and also the final one that had like the format that the show stuck with for the past 6 seasons, which is where the Doctor and his companions are basically like a vagabond on the TARDIS, where they have no idea where they're going, but that's kind of part of the excitement, where like they really just end up anywhere or any time. However, that was also one of the problems that the show was causing, because each time the Doctor landed somewhere else, they needed to get a new cast of guest actors, and then also new exotic sets, set pieces, and props for each new exotic location that they went in. And since a lot of their budget would start to be spent on like more colorful set pieces and also actual color videotape in the 1970s, they decided that it was no longer possible for them to be producing episodes on the budget that they currently were. So basically, in their attempt to slash the budget, this is what they came up with. So they screened the Doctor without the TARDIS, so that beginning with their Doctor, a lot of his episodes would be set in present-day Earth, so that they could really be reusing the same same guest actors and also set pieces. So it's interesting to think about how the two writers of this were basically assigned this. They were given a really specific endpoint where they had to get rid of the whole cast and then screen the Doctor on Earth, and then also have the Doctor regenerate for the second time. So they were given a really specific endpoint, and they were also told that they had to do it in 10 episodes. And yeah, I think, again, with the structure that they did it, it was really effective with having it be a sort of mystery plot. And also with the beginning, it was really exciting to have to kind of explore a variety of locations based on the given war zones. Like how they start off in the World War I zone, and then eventually the Roman zone. And then near the end, the Time Lords get involved. And then I feel like the middle section of the serial is where it possibly ran the risk of kind of growing the most repetitive, because a lot of the action in those sets of episodes take place within the central base and have a lot of the same set locations. And personally, I feel like even then the serial managed to kind of hold my interest, because even then there was still a lot of interesting things going on, like basically the kind of the relationship between the Doctor and the Warlord, the War Chief, because they were both, it was revealed that the War Chief was also a Time Lord, and then that was how we first learned, like, for the first time in 6 seasons, we actually found out some stuff about the Doctor's background and where he came from. And then there was also kind of the conflict between the War Chief and then the Security Chief, because they both didn't trust each other, and the Security Chief thought that the War Chief was basically would be acting as a Time Lord to backstab all of them. And then this part of a plot with where he attempted for the Doctor, who's of course another Time Lord, to also reach there. So probably just by my saying that, that kind of sounds really complicated, but told slowly over the course of those episodes. For me, it was really interesting. And also, I feel like since they knew that starting next season, their budget would be slashed, I feel like they kind of, they really, compared to like the previous serials, I feel like they really tried to go all out on the budget and really make this like a grand finale for the second Doctor, and then really to the end of the era of the show where they could just really use the TARDIS. For example, I thought the World War I sets were really impressive. I remember reading somewhere that their goal was to make them as convincing as possible so that they could mislead the viewer as to what kind of a story this would be, and think that this would actually be like a pure historical serial without any sci-fi elements. And then also they had the World War I era ambulances and then vehicles. And then during the Civil War, in the Civil War zone, they also had like live horses. So I thought that was really impressive for 1960s television production standards. And I guess something that I find really interesting, just because it's so different from how television is produced now, is basically how television, like dramas in the 50s were made, was basically seen as like a successor to live theater, where they were basically performed and broadcast live. And then in the 60s, this was kind of like barely a step up from that, where basically they would spend like the entire week just kind of rehearsing for the episode. And then for this show they would spend the whole week rehearsing for it, and then within like the time span of an hour and a half on Friday nights, they would film the episode. So a lot of those scenes would be basically filmed in one take, because they couldn't really afford to have more videotapes, like record second takes. So sometimes there would be line flubs and things like that that would work their way into the episodes. And if like the mistake wasn't too bad, then the actors would improvise and try their best to work it out.
Now this also, if I think you told me that this is from this point on, it would be possible for a viewer to watch every episode of Doctor Who for the first time.
That's right, because the final missing episode is the one that comes right before this one. So it's like the final episode of the serial that's right before this.
So this is something else from 1960s television. They would tape over master tapes. They would lose tapes. Nobody really realized the historical significance of what they were doing when they're in the middle of it. So things like The Tonight Show, those classic early episodes of Johnny Carson, or the earlier hosts, many of those are lost. So many of these are lost, and some are recreated. But from this point on, you know, you've got these pivots in a lot of ways that you mentioned earlier. And this is just one more of them where from this point on, everything's been preserved.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that Doctor Who was one of these shows that was really struck by the BBC's policy wiping episodes. For example, Patrick Troughton, who is of course the second Doctor in this serial, his first 11 episodes are completely missing. So it's really unfortunate that we have what we do have, and even this final serial of 10 episodes is completely existing. And it's interesting how actually the first two seasons from which would have been from 63 to 65 are actually very well represented, because that was when what is called Dalek Mania hit, which was where the Daleks were introduced, and they really helped to boost the viewership numbers, and they really captured the nightmares and imaginations of the children all over England. So these were episodes that were really popular, and they were very broadcast. They were sold and broadcast to a lot of different countries. Like, they were sold to Australia and Nigeria, and so these episodes were just sent to a lot of different locations. And even though in England in the early 70s a lot of these episodes were junked, we were able to get a lot of these back by having them sent back from a lot of these foreign broadcasting companies. But yeah, it's another thing that's really interesting about how these episodes were made. So they would usually be filmed within roughly the span of an hour and a half on Friday nights. And then I guess they had time for like editing and sound mixing and stuff. And then the following Saturday, so that would have been like 8 weeks after the episode was filmed, it would be broadcast. And I feel like for a show that's serialized, that kind of seems really risky. So basically they were still filming parts of the serial as they were broadcasting it. And of course that seems like that could cause a lot of problems. If like an actor is sick and can't film like the week's episode, and because they really have no time to wait until they get well or anything. And sometimes during this show they would have basically, they would like have last minute script changes or rewrites where they would try their best to like write a character out of it, or they would have like a body double so that the character in story would collapse, and then you just see like the body double collapse from like a far away angle. And even though I feel like in terms of budget this was I guess a higher profile serial for Doctor Who, at least what had been made up to that point, I think we did also point out that there were some 1960s like campiness values, and these were for the controls of the villains' TARDISes. They were really like these fruit magnets, and then they would like pull these across like the magnetic surface. And then at one point the Doctor like is supposedly stealing these like controls that the villains can't operate them, and it looks like he's basically stealing these fridge magnets. And then another thing was the goggles that the villains will wear on the base. At one point when the Doctor and Zoe infiltrate the base, they put the goggles on in order to like disguise themselves. And they're like these white goggles that have like these kind of black plus signs over the eyes, and they kind of look like how cartoon characters, when they're dead, they'll like have these X's drawn over their eyes to indicate that. But again, at that point when you actually get to the alien base and a lot of those sci-fi elements creep in, that's around like maybe the fourth episode, and I feel like by that time the viewer would be invested in the story. At least like the very beginning of the serial with all of the World War One action and Civil War action, all that stuff seems really authentic. So even when I feel like those inevitable 1960s like sci-fi camp creeps in, I feel like because the viewer would be so invested enough, they would I feel like they I guess be willing to like cut it some slack.
That's a good point, because at this point, once they reveal those, you're already on the ride. So you're invested enough that you want to see where it goes. You've hopped on the bus and you want to see the destination. And you're going to be less forgiving, or more forgiving rather, of seeing those kind of campy elements or obvious, what would come across as kind of cheap effects.
Something that I felt was actually ahead of its time was the acting for the villains. I feel like the villains were a really big part of this because not only were there I feel like five main big ones, but they were also really interesting in terms of the acting, and also each one had like their own set of motivations where they didn't really entirely trust the other. I feel like when you think of like 1960s TV acting, you think of it as like villain acting, you think of it as very like theatrical and like where the villains will like yell at their subordinates and kind of get cheesy, but I feel like the acting in like the serial from the villains, it was actually very subtle, and it did a good job of I feel like I guess really playing the threat seriously and really helped us to I feel take the villain seriously as well. In fact, speaking of the villains, something that I really picked up on this viewing, this was my second viewing of this serial, but something I picked up this time that I didn't really pick up on the first time was I feel like I actually picked up on their like parallels to Star Wars, particularly within the relationship between the Doctor and the War Chief. I felt that was kind of reminiscent of the relationship between Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader, because they're both the Doctor finds out that he's actually from the same race as the War Chief, and then the War Chief tries to lure the Doctor to the dark side, and then because he feels since they have this sort of special bond and connection, he'll be able to get the Doctor to betray his friends in order to join them. And the War Chief, even though he seems like really powerful, he's actually the second in command to the Warlord. And then similarly in Star Wars, Luke finds out that Darth Vader is really his father, and then Darth Vader, because after Darth Vader finds out this information, he tries to lure Luke to betray his friends and then lure him to the dark side. And then even though Darth Vader, like, he seems like really powerful, but he's actually the second in command to Emperor Palpatine. In Star Wars, George Lucas has actually said that he is a Whovian or a Doctor Who fan, and it was an influence to him when he made Star Wars. And this serial would have been made and broadcast 8 years before Star Wars was. And I don't think these set of episodes would have been broadcast to America. It'll be a while before that would happen, but I mean, it was interesting since it's interesting to think about what exactly influence Doctor Who had on the eventual creation of Star Wars.
Interesting.
Another thing that's really interesting with the acting is that there are actually two actors that have relationships to either other cast members or crew members. The first one was the actress who played Lady Jennifer, who was a World War I nurse who stuck with the Doctor and his companions for maybe the first half of the serial. She was actually the wife of the producer of the serial. And then the other one was actually Patrick Troughton's son, David Troughton, who played a Civil War soldier named Gamorre, who only appeared in episode 6, and it was his job to guard one of the, I guess one of the villains. And apparently, I found out that he had actually played a security guard in an episode from one of the from the previous season, but he went uncredited for that, so this is his first credited appearance in Doctor Who. And he would actually make a number of reappearances as different characters. And the most recent one of these was actually in a 2008 episode with the 10th Doctor. So it's interesting how one of the second Doctor's sons had would I guess stay with the series so long even after his father left. And then, yeah, something else I wanted to touch on was something that, so I mentioned how the series serial had two writers, which were Terence Dicks, who was the script editor of the show at the time, and then also Malcolm Hulk. And Hulk died in, I think, the late 70s, but Terence Dicks actually passed away only a couple of years ago. And he, and when asked about his thoughts on the serial, he said, "In the past, I was always a bit apologetic about the War Games at conventions. I'd say, the opening episode's good. They're in the First World War and a Roman chariot comes out of the mist. That's a great moment. At the end, with the trial of the Doctor when he's condemned to turn into the Third Doctor, is good. But in between, there's a lot of running up and down corridors, escapes, and captures. When it came out on DVD, there was a big review in the Doctor Who magazine which said, 'Terence has been talking nonsense. It's excellent all the way through. I was highly delighted to be proved wrong.'" And I will say that I feel like a lot of the fandom now, basically everyone also agrees that the first and last moments of the serial are great. And I feel like also most fans really see the serial as a whole as nothing less than amazing and really fitting into the second Doctor. But there's definitely a big part of the fandom that holds Terence Dix's prior views toward the serial. Basically how it has a good beginning and a strong ending, but that's basically sandwiching kind of this like fluffy middle portion that's basically a lot of padding with repetitive escapes and things like that. And it probably didn't really need to be 10 episodes long. So I'm curious if you have like anything to weigh in on that.
Well, I could see that if they had been given the mandate to do this in 7 episodes or 8 episodes, they probably could have done that. They could have tightened it up a little bit. But I think that the overall arc and the ability to kind of peel back more layers of that onion to reveal more about what is really going on here. To go through a number of different twists and turns where you're finding out that this isn't what you thought it was, there's something else going on behind here. To also explore the backstory of the Doctor, there is a lot here. So, exploring that over the course of 10 episodes, I think worked well. And I think, we talked a little bit about some of the cheesy elements of it. But, it's difficult to assess it now in our current day, taking a look back at 1969 television. And it occurs to me that this was quite an achievement for that time and space, if you were.
Yeah, I feel like that's really how I feel about it too. Like, it didn't need to be that long. I mean, this is 10 episodes long, and each episode of this show was 25 minutes. So if you do the math, that's a total of 4 hours and 10 minutes long. But while it didn't need to be that long, I feel like the writers also didn't need to go into that much complexity as they did, and create as much detail and as much backstory. I feel like they really succeeded in justifying that the 10 episodes was worth it. And this wasn't the longest serial that the classics series did, but I feel like this was the longest serial that was actually that really maintained a consistent quality all throughout and really justified its running time. And maybe my final question is, because this is such an important episode because this is really the end of the Second Doctor, and I know you had kind of like a vague understanding of how like this show worked with how the Doctor would regenerate. So I was wondering if you had sort of like an expectation or kind of like an assumption as to how a regeneration episode from like the show's older days would have felt like, and if this like serial kind of how the serial would compare to them, because I kind of wanted you to have like a spoiler free like opinion and view of the serial, so I purposely didn't tell you anything about how the serial would end.
I think this is kind of a unique structure for episodic television, where you've got a main character that changes.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, you return for the next season, and you've got a different actor playing that role. And it's hard to think of a parallel. You know, you did have television back then where on occasion an actor was replaced. But it wasn't part of the structure. It wasn't part of the intention. It was more a matter of changing an actor for whatever reason and making believe that the audience won't notice.
Mm-hmm.
This is one where you've got your main character and they suddenly change to a new actor. It's more like the Bond series of films where you've got a new actor playing 007.
Mm-hmm.
And a storyline that theoretically continues. So it's an interesting structure, one that I think gives you the ability to really kind of refresh the series from time to time. And maybe that's one of the reasons why the series has been on the air for
mm-hmm.
so many decades, which is so unusual. And it's interesting they've come up with a reasonable structure and explanation for why it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's such an interesting risk to take where you've got an audience that is built in and committed to a particular actor. And then all of a sudden, join us next
yeah.
year. We're going to try it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there like a part of the serial where like at what point did you kind of suspect that this might be Patrick's final episode, or did you not really realize that until it actually started to happen at the end of episode 10?
I think I knew that that was going to happen. I'm not sure, you know, how I knew, but I didn't know how it was going to happen or how they would go about justifying it, and you know they worked it into the plot line in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as I said, it's a unique element of television, the way that they've
yeah.
done this.
Yeah, I agree that. I think probably one of the most like most similar comparisons would be the James Bond series and how that has given actors. But even then, those are like, I guess each actor in the James who plays James Bond kind of takes on their own personality or take or era of the franchise, but they're sort of supposed to still be the same character. And then Doctor Who, they even in story, it is like they take on like a new personality with their new appearance, although they still retain their memories and like basically that passion for what the Doctor believes in, which is where he has that urge to go exploring with companions and basically bring justice to whatever evil he finds out there in the cosmos. And I think it's also great at adding stakes for the series, because obviously they can't completely kill off the Doctor, because that'll be the end of the show, and they are gonna end the show with 60 like nearly 60 years of worth of history. But I feel like it still adds stakes if you think that, oh, the Gyakugyu could actually regenerate in this one, because regeneration is kind of established as basically being kind of a form of death. When the Time Lord's body sort of dies, and that's how they survive, they regenerate into a new body and a new person. And then the same thing goes with the Gyakugyu's companions. Like, the serial saw the departure of both Jamie and Zoe. And I think that also adds stakes. You don't know when the companion will leave, or even if a companion will make it out of this one, as in some rare cases, the show has actually killed off its companions. And yeah, you mentioned how it's really interesting for the audience to tune in and have given actors play the same character. And I feel like that's most apparent here, because in the next serial, it's a brand new actor playing the doctor and like a brand new companion too. So, I mean, this serial just completely wipes the cast out in one big sweep, which was really the only time that completely happened in the classic series, where it's just that much of a get cut off.
Just add one more pivot to this series with the series of episodes.
And I guess one more final kind of interesting fact is that on IMDb, the 10th episode of the serial is actually the second highest rated episode of Classic Who, with an average user rating of 9.1. So, yeah, of course, I mean, fans really view this serial really highly. At least the beginning and endings, they have some disagreements as to the extent of how much padding is packed in the middle and how much of that is necessary or justified. But I mean, yeah, you heard it here. I really thought that the writer is really justified all of that, and yeah, it's generally one of my favorite series of the show, and I feel like it's really probably the greatest achievement of the 60s era of Doctor Who.
It was a lot of fun to watch it.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining me. I enjoyed discussing it. And this is such an odd cinema and sound.